You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2009, the 16th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Montreal, Canada, from February 8th through February 11th, 2009.
In these study summaries, Mari Kitahata of the University of Washington in Seattle and Jonathan Stern of the University of Bristol in the UK discussed the results of their studies regarding optimal timing of antiretroviral therapy. After the discussion, there will be a series of questions and answers.
We've been struggling with this question of when to initiate HART in asymptomatic HIV-infected patients for some time, largely because methodology is quite complex and the sample size required to address the question requires large numbers of patients over a long period of time. So, as you know, recent U.S. guidelines recommend treating all asymptomatic patients with a CD4 count less than 350. In a previous study, we examined patients who either initiated or deferred HART at a CD4 count between 351 and 500 and found a significant improvement in survival. Emerging data about the continued potential harm of ongoing chronic inflammation and HIV replication and potential persistent and permanent immunologic defects raises the question that even earlier in HIV disease, at a CD4 count greater than 500, could significantly improve survival. Again, to address some of the major challenges, we used more advanced statistical methods that allow for mimicking a clinical trial using observational data. We also combined data from all of the major HIV cohorts in North America, throughout the U.S. and Canada, and examined patients who were enrolled at the same CD4 cell count level above 500 between 1996 and 2006. 9,155 patients were enrolled in the study. They all had a CD4 count greater than 500. They were had never received antiretroviral treatment and were AIDS-free. And 29%, or 2,616, began taking HART at a CD4 count greater than 500, and the remaining 71% deferred. After controlling for potential confounding factors, we found a 60% higher risk of mortality for patients who deferred treatment at a CD4 count greater than 500. Our findings suggest that therapy earlier in HIV infection could significantly prolong survival. We designed our study to address the effect of HART on all-cause mortality. I think the growing appreciation of the importance of non-AIDS conditions such as liver, cardiovascular, renal disease, not previously thought to be related to HIV, make it important not to use simply a combined endpoint of a composite time to AIDS event or death. And so we designed our study to look at all-cause mortality. The next steps in our analyses will be to look at causes of mortality and collect information in more detail on the non-AIDS serious conditions. And our plans are to do modeling that involve looking at competing risks of those events and the earlier initiation of HART in the North American cohort.
Thank you. Jonathan.
Our study also addressed the question of the CD4 cell count at which it's beneficial for either rates of AIDS and death or for mortality rates to start treatment with combination therapy. We analyzed data from cohorts contributing to the ART cohort collaboration. It's a collaboration that I lead that has produced a number of publications looking at the prognosis of HIV-infected patients from the time that they started therapy. As Murray said, the statistical analysis of this issue in observational data is complicated, and what you'd like to do is to mimic a randomized trial that randomized people to start at a higher CD4 threshold or defer to a lower CD4 range. From the data in the ART cohort collaboration, we follow people from the start of therapy, so we're missing the data that you would have in an RCT on time from in the people who deferred. There are two possibilities. They could either progress to AIDS or die without ever starting treatment, or they could have some time off treatment before they started. And we've accounted for those things by using data on 21,000 people from seven cohort studies that followed people in the pre-HART era from 1989 to 95, so before effective combination therapy became available. We looked at different thresholds for starting HART, starting lower range, for example, by comparing a strategy of initiating the range 200 to 100 compared with deferring to the range 100 to 0. And then we increase the threshold in increments of 25 until comparing initiating in the range 550 to 450 with deferring to the range 450 to 350. And first thing to say about our findings is that they clearly demonstrate the substantial adverse effects of delayed treatment in the lower CD4 ranges. So they show that delaying to below 250 cells per mil is clearly associated with increased rates of AIDS and death as a combined endpoint and of mortality, and that really emphasizes the need to diagnose HIV infection early enough to get people on treatment when they can benefit most from it. We found some evidence that starting at above 350 cells per mil, as recommended following recent changes to guidelines, is beneficial comparing to deferring to the range 350 to 250 with a hazard ratio of 1.28, and that's for rates of AIDS and death. Effects on mortality were somewhat were less dramatic, and we didn't find benefit on from starting at above ranges of approximately 400. So our hazard ratios are somewhat more conservative, closer to 1 than those estimated in the NA Accord study.
Can I just ask the duration of follow-up after initiation in both studies?
So we restricted to patients who'd started therapy after 1998 on the basis that combination therapy was less effective in 96 to 97 than subsequently. And duration of follow-up, I think the median, I have to look it up, is about 3 years with follow-up of up to about 6 years.
Mari?
Yeah, I think I want to point out the strength of the two different methods that we used, having somewhat similar findings. A difference in our study is that we started everyone at the same starting point at greater than 500, so it was a head-to-head comparison that didn't involve the lead time issue. And had 28,000 person-years of follow-up. The method we applied to be able to mimic a randomized trial included informative censoring, and therefore the median time is somewhat altered by including the time up to censoring. But it was similar in approximately 3.5 years and up to 8 years in some patients.
So I remember several years ago when initial data were presented in short-term follow-up, looking at, you know, AIDS or death, that the field tended to move towards reaching the edge of the precipice and how close you could get without showing a signal that there was a greater risk of a deferral strategy. Now I sense, and I think it's the right thing, that we're going to be moving away from that, and we have moved away from that, get to the precipice and then start, to honing in on higher and higher CD4 starting points.
You said that you looked at all-cause mortality, but did you see any other benefits or harm with starting treatment earlier other than the intuitive quality of life things?
Well, again, I think you're raising the issue of important factors that are different about patients in routine care that may even be different from more selected patients in clinical trials. So I want to emphasize that it took getting to the question also of treatment. The NA Accord encompasses almost 100,000 patients overall, and the greater than 500 start period, at least in the U.S., was in the hard hit early David Ho era. And so the peak of our initiation of therapies was with the older therapies, and actually the peak was only 16% of a given set of patients within a year initiating greater than 500, and that was in 1998. So we're looking at the majority of people who were treated with non-boosted PIs, with the second group being the NNRTI-based regimens. Importantly, we looked at all comers, so it included people who had injection drug use, hepatitis C virus infection, and other potential factors that might be associated with increased mortality, as well as potentially the exposure group. And our results were robust when controlling for those things. We were not We were not addressing specific issues of other outcomes, and we are, again, collecting data now on non-AIDS morbidity and mortality, and those will be important things to examine in the future studies.
The new guidelines that came out in August last suggested that 350 was a good place to start, but that you could start at above 500 if you wanted. I'm wondering if the data that you're presenting, in your view, should alter guidelines at all. Is it strong enough to say, well, no, let's just go put 500 as a lower bound, or how do you see it playing into that whole guideline mess?
Yeah. Thank you for the question. I mean, I think our previous study that was presented at ICAC that is hopefully going to be published shortly demonstrated a significant improvement in survival starting at a CD4 count of 351 to 500. So clearly for all patients, and the guidelines in the DHHS guidelines and the IAS USA guidelines all make the threshold cutoff of 350 for all asymptomatic patients to start below that level, but make exceptions for other subgroups of patients, perhaps those with renal disease, hepatitis, and even cardiovascular disease, that there's indications that those subgroups of patients perhaps would benefit even more with earlier therapy. But what I can tell you is that, and so now this study shows that a threshold of 500, which again, remember, is not near normal, but above 500 is associated with significant improvement overall over the 10-year period of the study. So patients with other comorbid conditions, such as hepatitis C virus infection, benefited from the earlier treatment, perhaps even more. And there was still an independent effect of mortality for having those conditions above and beyond the benefit of starting heart earlier.
So I think our answers at this point diverge somewhat because in the analyses that I'm presenting later on, we did see evidence of benefit from starting at above 350, but if we go up to thresholds as high as 450, we didn't see evidence of further reductions in rates of AIDS and death or mortality. I think it's important to emphasize for our analysis, possibly for the NACORD analysis as well, these are analyses of observational data, and there is always a possibility that the analyses are affected by confounding. So if beyond what we've measured in the data, there are factors that are associated with a patient's prognosis that lead their doctors to postpone treatment, then that could bias the results and make the benefit from starting earlier look better than it really is. And the final point I'd make is that starting above 350, absolute rates of mortality and absolute rates of AIDS and death combined are actually relatively low. So the higher you put your threshold, the greater, the smaller the absolute benefit in terms of your, say, three-year risk of dying becomes. And so when absolute benefits are small, you then do have to think about balancing the benefit against disadvantages such as treatment toxicity.
Can I just make two further comments? We did two additional analyses addressing that issue. One which, although these are complex Cox regression analyses, we did do an estimated calculated cumulative mortality rate that demonstrated that the absolute risk of death for patients deferring at a CD4 count greater than 500 was significantly higher throughout the 10-year period of the study. The other analysis we did was a Monte Carlo simulation to address the issue of unmeasured confounding. So after controlling for calendar year, cohort, sex, age, race, history of IDU, HCV infection, CD4 viral load, we looked at whether an unmeasured confounder could have mitigated our results. And what we found was that a confounder would have to have an association of relative hazard of mortality of 4 and an odds ratio associated with deferral of treatment of 4 to reduce the relative hazard of our results from a mortality risk of deferral of 1.6 to only 1.3. So an unmeasured confounder would have to be extremely large to mitigate the results that we found.
So let me ask both of you, how after your presentations, how feasible will be a randomized clinical trial of deferred versus immediate therapy in individuals at whatever threshold you want.
Well, I think the points Jonathan is making about observational data are very important, and that's why we went the extra mile to really try to do all the things that we could do to address potential confounding. And we feel that we've applied those methods and had robust results in all the sensitivity analyses we've done. The advantage of observational data is that we have been able to analyze data on a cohort of 100,000 patients overall over a 10-year period between 96 and 2006 in a collaboration that has only just begun. And so I think, you know, any study that will try to address this question will take large numbers of patients and long periods of time. And that is one of the advantages of a prospectively collected cohort data that can help to address that issue. I think, you know, again, even a very large randomized trial would be needed to balance all unmeasured factors between treatment and control groups. But certainly, observational data has the potential for confounding to remain.
Anything to add to that?
So the question is it feasible? And my colleagues who are involved in proposing such a trial tell me that it absolutely is feasible. If you believe it's feasible, I think then the question is, should it be done? And I kind of would say that's slightly above my pay grade, but you're going to balance the potential cost of potentially some tens of millions of dollars of doing such a trial against the fact that only by doing a trial and a well-conducted trial can you definitively answer the question in terms of excluding confounding by factors that you don't measure in the cohorts. And I guess I'm still very struck by the fact that the SMART trial, which as I understand it was also a trial that was hotly debated before it happened, that's the trial of treatment interruption versus continuous treatment, produced results that were unexpected at the time the trial was conceived and that have really informed the way we understand the benefits of therapy since then.
You mentioned that, you know, you said that 500, of course, is not normal or whatever, but we also know that normal CD4 counts tend to vary by racial, ethnic groups and things like that. Have you done any analysis along those lines? And might there be some implication if we're going to start at higher CD4 counts, whether those might be better guided or framed with along racial ethnic lines and what is normal for those particular patient populations?
Yeah, it's a complex question. I think what I can say from our data is that we, you know, race is a difficult variable and there's misclassification because it's self-reported. And the classifications used in Canada are a bit different from the U.S., and they're never perfect measures, I think, of what they're trying to measure. But given those caveats, we did include the major categories of white race, black race, Hispanic, and other, and did not find an effect of race on our results. And so, you know, there are many ways in which those kinds of factors can impact patient outcomes, but it was not a major factor in our study.
Many of us believe that we have lost enormous ground in fighting the epidemic over the past number of years as guidelines for treatment have become more and more conservative out of fear of side effects of treatment. And I'm wondering how you reconcile your data with other data that is continuing to be discussed at meetings like this earlier today, regarding risk for cardiovascular side effects and metabolic side effects.
Talking about some of these issues over breakfast this morning, and one of the points that came up in that conversation is that the real problem, the problem for the majority of patients is that they are not diagnosed and therefore not treated until their CD4 counts are well below even what the current guidelines say. So as Mari says, even, what was it, in 98 at the peak of a treat hard, treat early, it was only 16% of patients. And the main reason that patients in rich countries are not treated is just not diagnosed. So if you're worried about the public health impact, then I think Mari and I and pretty much everyone else can agree that if you get a patient with 250 cells, they should be treated. Why are they not treated? Primarily, it's because they haven't yet been diagnosed. And in public health terms, I think that raises issues of you know, should we be looking harder for undiagnosed infection?
Yeah, I think, you know, the dramatic improvement in survival since the advent of HART has made HIV a chronic disease in resource-rich countries, at least. And this is due to dramatic decline in AIDS-defining illnesses. But as we're appreciating more and more, there are also HIV contributions to these classically non-AIDS-related conditions. And so there are several recent reviews of this. Judy Aberg did one that was quite informative about cardiovascular risk. And I think, again, it's a very complex issue. And clearly, as Jonathan pointed out, SMART informed us that some of these quote-unquote non-AIDS conditions are, in fact, contributed to by HIV infections significantly and have declined in the HART era, and that the cardiovascular risks and toxicities that are a hot area of investigation and need much further work are actually modest compared with the benefits of HART.
The opinions expressed by host or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from CROI 2009. For more coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2009.